From WNYC, New York Public Radio, this is the podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show, and I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of today's show. The rest of today's show is available for download and on-demand listening at WNYC.org. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC podcasts are supported by Holy Name Hospital in Teaneck, New Jersey, providing comprehensive centers in cardiovascular services, interventional radiology, and cancer care. More information at www.holyname.org.
As chief elections and voting patterns analyst for the 1968 Nixon campaign, Kevin Phillips is credited with predicting the Southern strategy that led to the realignment of the Republican Party towards Sunbelt social conservatives. But over the ensuing 38 years, he's come to regret that those predictions came true. In his most recent book, American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century, he argues that largely as a result of the realignment of oil, religion, and debt, America is facing an end to its supremacy. His book is published by Viking, and I'm very pleased that it brings him back to my show today. Hi.
Hi, happy to be here.
In pretty much everything that's written about you, the first sentence refers to the emerging Republican majority. That was 1969. What are your feelings about that book now?
Well, it was a very defining book for me.
It made you famous.
Oh, yeah. I guess I answer that in two layers. The first, and I've already been asked, and I would vote for Richard Nixon in that race again as against Hubert Humphrey. The Democrats were exhausted by war, by urban breakdown, by riots, by inflation. They just run out of the whatever genius there had been in the New Deal coalition. What's unfortunate, of course, is the way the Republican coalition worked out. Now, my analysis of when it really started heading into the religious dimension, which is now so controlling, would be pretty much in the 1880s. And oddly enough, not nearly as much under Ronald Reagan, who could control them pretty easily and didn't have to pander, as under George H.W. Bush, who had to pander because they didn't like him. And then most of all under his son, who broke into national politics as his father's liaison with a religious right. People don't remember that.
Mm-hmm. Well, the religious political leanings in the past, with William Jennings Bryan and the like, were usually on the left. It's only been since the 20s or so that we've seen this move in the other direction. Isn't that true?
I think it's more complicated than that, but I wouldn't try to explain it in less than a chapter of
Well,
a book.
Let's not even bother.
No, I'll explain very quickly that normally you get a radicalization through religion in a way that's more associated with the left or populism or something that's plebeian. But as you get radicalizations of politics in the 20th century that are more the radicalization of the middle, it's not surprising that you're getting a radicalization of what's in essence sort of almost a suburban megachurch fundamentalism.
In its review of your book, Time magazine says you've become a declinist. Is that how you would describe yourself?
Well, no, but I understand why people would use that term. Essentially, my view is that when we look back historically, the United States will have been seen to peak by different yardsticks, but in a roughly 25-year period between, say, 1980 and the present, or a little bit further out, but I'd say it's already in motion. And that was camouflaged by what happened in the breakup of the Soviet Union. But now we see that in the United States and its economy, in terms of internal tensions in the country and the tendency to overreach globally, we learned very little from the decline of the Soviets. We just went out and looked for a new grandiosity to pursue.
But haven't there been predictions in every decade about America's decline? In the 1970s, because of the oil crisis, Watergate, the Vietnam War, and then in the 1980s when everyone was sure that Japan was going to pass us economically, If you look at the polls, Americans believe that things will continue as they usually have and will stumble through any future crises as we have in the past.
Well, I'm not sure that's what they believe, because it's hard to ask a question that encompasses very much. Certainly Americans think we're on the wrong track. And I think wrong track is something that relates to this sense that there's a problem out there, and we don't know how far along it is. But I would go back and say, by some yardsticks, of course, America's peak share of world trade and world manufacturing came back in the 60s and 70s, and there was a down movement in the 80s. The huge buildup of debt was beginning in the 70s and 80s. The overreach in Vietnam, which then fed into a kind of countertrend in the Reagan era, but then that was disguised by the breakup of the Soviet Union, and here we overreach again, and we have what could be worse than Vietnam in the Middle East.
So all the problems that you see today, we can find starting at earlier times this financialization that we'll talk about later. But let's talk first about what you called the Texification of American politics. What do you mean by that?
Well, the Texification, I suppose the obvious conclusion is that we're talking about the Bushes. But I would go back before that, when Richard Nixon was looking for a way to cement the Republicans in the new Sun Belt axis. One of the first things he thought about was getting Texas and oil into that package, because John Connally in 1968 held Texas for the Democrats. And then Connally, of course, later, by the end of the first Nixon administration, was ready to switch and ultimately did. So the idea that Texas was the buckle on the new Republican Sun Belt was quite true. What happened then in the 70s and 80s was that as the oil crisis and crises, the various ones, heated up, it became clearer and clearer that the future of the United States was more bound up with oil, and there was a problem that we had to guarantee it in the Middle East. And so you started to get a Texification that also related to a willingness to intervene in the Middle East, and that was the George Bush Sr. and this one.
And it's been pointed out that a lot of the people in the White House these days have connections, have pasts in oil. You say that the invasion of Iraq was really about access to oil and U.S. global supremacy. Hasn't the White House dismissed that claim in the past as just conspiracy thinking?
The White House, frankly, in terms of what they dismiss and what they understand, it's kindergarten-level stuff. Because if you go back to George H.W. Bush and James Baker, Secretary of State, the 41st president admitted that we had to be there because we couldn't let Saddam Hussein have the oil resources of the Middle East.
Well, he was taking over Kuwait to
yes,
gain access to
Kuwait. Yes, but it was to keep
oil.
From Saddam from aggrandizing himself, and the reference was oil. And then James Baker just broadly spoke about how the Middle East and oil went together, as they had ever since FDR started knowing that the future of oil was in the Middle East around the time of World War II. And in part of my book, I get into the developments in the 20th century that you can virtually say there's 100 years war that's involved oil in the Middle East. And the notion that this was somehow about democracy, I mean, to me, that's a joke. However, there are several things you can say that camouflage the oil basis of the involvement. The first is that they were already antsy in the White House that they might not be able to stay in Saudi Arabia because of all the resentment that was building up there. And if you had to pull out of Saudi Arabia, you had to replace the bases and you had to possibly replace the oil. So that geopolitical strategy, although it was underpinned by oil, was also something more. Then secondarily, you had the Bush, two generations of Bushes, and the sensitivity to Saddam Hussein and the family grudgemanship. And then finally, what I would say is that if you have a desire to take over Iraq for geopolitical and oil reasons, and you get 9/11, you get the perfect excuse to go in there, provided you can put it in a larger context. Now, we all know the larger context was terrorism in part. But what becomes clear when you study the Republican Party is that it was also a religious and a biblical politics context. The series, the Left Behind series by Tim LaHaye, the preacher, that sold 60 million copies. This was all about the period of the great battle that would take place in the Middle East as the end times went into Armageddon. This is very central to the born-agains in the Republican Party, and they're a huge coalition.
Well, the president was asked about the religious influences on his foreign policy yesterday. He took questions from a group in Cleveland, and let's listen to the first one that he was asked.
He makes the point that members of your administration have reached out to prophetic Christians who see the war in Iraq and the rise of terrorism as signs of the apocalypse. Do you believe this?
And then the president had a long pause, and this is how he responded.
The answer is, I haven't really thought of it that way. Here's how I think of it. First, I've heard of that, by the way. I guess I'm more of a practical fella.
So what do you think of his response, Kevin?
Well, he clearly wasn't anticipating the question. If he had been, he'd have had a better answer. The problem here, and let me take it in a couple of layers, because I think it is important. This is Pandora's box that's starting to open up. Back at the millennium, turn of the century, Newsweek took a poll, and 45% of American Christians said they believed that we were headed for Armageddon, that the great battle would be fought, and almost as many thought the Antichrist was already alive. Now, the people who felt the strongest were the evangelicals and the fundamentalists, the mainstream Protestant and Catholics were way, way down the list. So I have to assume, on the basis of my political analysis that goes back 50 years or so, that essentially 50 to 60% of the Bush electorate believes in Armageddon. And what you have here, in addition, is an evangelical and fundamentalist electorate that believes that religious principles should be central in foreign policy. And roughly 55% of them believe that. And a number of Republicans, it's up in the 40s. Now, this is totally different than the rest of the electorate, but what I'm saying is that the Bush coalition, the people who gave him their votes in 2000 and 2004, are probably, to an extent hardly any Americans realize, committed in their minds to at least partially a biblical interpretation of what goes on in that region. Several of evangelicals have said that with the breakup of the Soviet Union, the focus of the evangelicals shifted to Islam. And that was the threat. And this goes all the way back to the Crusades with the bugaboo about Islam. And, I mean, there's a lot been written about that. So what you have here is that when Bush wanted to go into Iraq, okay, part of it was security. He's telling us about weapons of mass destruction. Turned out not to be true. But the fundamentalists and evangelicals wedded to this clash of evil and good in the Middle East wouldn't have cared about that. And people had talked, and you can get this in lots of places, about Saddam Hussein might have been the Antichrist, and that Baghdad was the New Babylon, and that's where the Lahaye books were set, New Babylon.
In fact, Iraq is where much of the first part of the Old Testament is set. The roots of Judeo-Christian philosophy and everything else start there. Did people see this as a confirmation of prophecies?
I just wonder in my mind what George W. Bush knows about this backdrop, because Howard Feynman of Newsweek did an excellent article 3 years ago about George Bush and his whole born-again approach. And he noted, as Bush was getting ready to go into Iraq, that he was reading each morning from a book of prayers and observations. I think the name of the preacher was Chambers, but it was a chaplain with the British forces that were getting ready to go into Palestine. This was to capture Jerusalem. And this was what he studied as he was getting ready to invade Iraq.
My guest is Kevin Phillips, and his latest book is American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. It is published by Viking. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. Is religious faith a bad idea? And is applying the precepts of a great religion a bad idea for governance?
The difficulty here is that usually when religion builds up a momentum of involvement in politics, it's not in a quiet, Jesus-like, if you take the biblical interpretation of Jesus-like way. It's, to cite one of my favorite hymns as a kid, "Onward, Christian Soldiers." And this is true of the Jews in the Bible, too. They were always fighting. And that the notion that this is a pacifist, quiet, constructive thing, when religion mobilizes, it's often pretty bloody. And if you go back and look at the leading world powers of the last four or five of them, from Rome down to Britain, in each case, sort of overambitious, proselytizing evangelical religion was part of the problem. It just wanted too much and wanted to go too far.
So what do you think are the Bush administration's plans for Iraq? To be a permanent military protectorate? Because religious reasons no longer apply, do they?
Well, let's put it this way. I'm not sure they have a well-thought-out plan for Iraq, because if they ever had one, they sure haven't followed it. But exactly what they think, there have been some magazine articles recently about how we've really built some big-time bases in Iraq, and there's just no likelihood we're pulling out. So the idea that we're withdrawing is really something of a facade for public opinion here in the States. My feeling is they don't want to leave, that they want to have this as a permanent base. They'd like to get the oil ultimately, and as long as they're working in that part of the Middle East, they have the chance to build this huge religious constituency into the construct.
But is this at all possible in the face of growing opposition, including from members of the president's own party?
Well, I haven't seen too many fundamentalist and evangelical preachers say he's botched it, that he sort of fumbled the Lord's forward pass, so to speak. I don't know what they think. I think they must be getting very concerned. Here's a man who went and landed on the aircraft carrier years back now and said, the war's over, and he had no idea what he was talking about. Now, what does he know now? I don't think anybody has a whole lot of faith. Now, if he really messes it up there, then what you have possibly is the beginning of a query in the minds of a lot of the evangelicals and fundamentalists. You know, he can't be talking to God. He's got to be talking to somebody who didn't know what he was doing.
But it also is causing a split within the president's conservative constituency, isn't it? Bruce Bartlett has written a book recently in which he's critical of the president's economic policies and the growing deficit, which we will get into later. He said that if he were voting today in the election, if Bill Clinton were running against George Bush, on totally economic grounds, he would vote for Clinton. He made it clear he didn't agree with him on other things. But he's also talked about permanent bases in Iraq, and he's disturbed by them as well. So, and now we have Francis Fukuyama writing a book critical of the president. Andrew Sullivan has come out against the war in Iraq. George Will seems to be changing his mind about it. Are we seeing a major split there?
Well, you can throw in Pat Buchanan and his magazine, The American Conservative. They totally oppose what developed as American policy in Iraq. So that is one ingredient of the split. But I can quote you, for example, from three well-known Republicans who are opposing him based on the fact that they see much too much attention to religion. Jack Danforth, the former senator from Missouri, said there was no excuse for some of these policies being followed, but you know, straight religious doctrine, it wasn't thoughtful policy. It was just right out of a religious demand. And a congressman from my own state of Connecticut, Chris Shays, basically said that the Republican Party of Lincoln has become the party of theocracy. In Rhode Island, the Republican Senator Lincoln Chafee said that more or less, this is what he said, that Bush's concept of sort of being empowered by God should be an issue.
Do you think that's one of the reasons that led the administration to totally misread the country on the Terry Schiavo case?
Yes, in a nutshell. I think that they have been convinced that this was a juggernaut and that the religious right was large enough and loyal enough that they could sort of pander to it and it would say, oh, wonderful, you know, you're doing us a great favor. But they're often so inept when they do something that then they embarrass their supporters. And they did in some ways in the Schiavo case. I think they are again in Iraq. And if it turns out that people of born-again conviction become something of a laughingstock because of George Bush. I don't think that's going to sit well at all. I don't think we're too far from that.
But just looking at the statistics, 2004 Fox News poll had 92% of the respondents saying they believed in God and 82% believed in miracles. An ABC poll from 2004 had 61% of the respondents believing that God created the earth in 6 days. I think that if I were George Bush, I might think, gee, I have a solid backing here.
Well, if you were George Bush, you probably would think that. You'd look at those numbers and then you'd say, wonderful. I think most people that do the polls will say that they don't know exactly what the numbers are, but take off somewhere between a quarter and a half of that because it's a kind of residual, you sort of like it. My mind is boggled by the Noah's Ark business, for example, at 60%. How many people in the United States do you think really take literally Noah's Ark? My guess would be no more than 20 to 30%, because others would say, oh, I know you can quibble, but there's probably something to it. And didn't they find some wreck in the Caucasus or something? And I myself have been half convinced by some of the Shroud of Turin evidence. So I just don't buy those. But if George Bush bought them, he bought himself a loser.
My guess is Kevin Phillips, who has written 13 books, including the New York Times bestsellers American Dynasty, The Politics of Rich and Poor, and Wealth and Democracy. His latest is American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. It's published by Viking. We will continue after this.
Don't wonder why he hasn't helped you when problems begin, if they begin, and I'm not saying they will, but if they do, just remember you just voted God out of your city. And if that's the case, then don't ask for his help, because he might not be there.
That's Pat Robertson talking about the people of Dover, Pennsylvania, who voted out a group of the Board of Education, who had decided that intelligent design should not be taught in the schools. I can't remember what percentage I read of evangelical ministers actually preached that their congregants had to vote for George Bush in the 2004 election. So have we crossed the line, do you think?
Well, there are a lot of ways in which we've crossed a line that has never been fully added up, because I think it's an important line and we have crossed it. On the other hand, what's happening now is George Bush loses national credibility. I think that the likelihood that this direction will be further fulfilled is being reduced. But it doesn't mean that the Bush White House and some of the Republican parties won't try to mobilize the churches again. It doesn't mean that they won't push abstinence as the national policy, international policy for AIDS. So it's a battle that's just beginning, but it may well have seen its worst.
My guest is Kevin Phillips, whose latest book is American Theocracy, The Peril and Politics of Radical Religion, Oil, and Borrowed Money in the 21st Century. It's published by Viking. Must tell you that I miss your commentaries on NPR. Was that something you decided not to continue doing?
Well, basically, I don't want to get into a thing about some of the changes in NPR, but I think there was more of a sense that developed that they should have more music and they should have more things that they didn't like hearing described as light, L-I-T-E, but I think there was an element of that. And I also got a little tired, frankly, of during the period when Bush seemed to be strongest, nobody wanted to rile him. And I'm not interested in saying anything that doesn't reflect my opinions. And I don't think they wanted to really go after him too much. And I figured, you know, what the hell, I'm almost 65. I don't really want to fight over this.
Well, there was a lot of pressure applied to public radio because some of its funding does come from the government. And we've seen heavy politicizing in that area, as in so many other areas, in the scientific area as well. Do you think that'll just end with this administration?
No, the battles won't end, but I think that the problems in terms of the public broadcasting will end with this administration, because that battle has been fought. In some ways, it was lost pretty quickly, but in some of the more embattled dimensions, I forget the name of the fellow. It's not important anyway, who ran the stuff and who was playing these acute games. They've obviously backed down on that. I would assume that by 2008, this is not going to be something everybody spends a lot of time worrying about.
But we will be worrying a lot about what you talk about in your last section of the book, Borrowed Prosperity, about America's unsustainable debt. How bad is it?
Well, it's really pretty bad, but part of it depends on how forbearing the rest of the world wants to be. Because the United States has run up huge debts. Some of them are international, some are domestic, some are public, some are private. But in some respects, the most dangerous one is to owe the rest of the world so much, because we don't make a lot of the things that we used to manufacture. We don't produce a lot of the oil, so we have to spend something like $500 billion a year bringing in the oil we need and the manufactured goods we don't make here. And the net result is we're going to be running huge current account deficits, which is net international borrowings for the foreseeable future. And the share of the U.S. GDP represented by the current account deficit, I realize this sounds remote, but it's not remote. That's the whole problem, is up to about 7%. And what this means is that central banks and other institutions overseas are accumulating these huge stocks of dollars and dollar-denominated bonds, treasury bonds. And if at some point they get annoyed at us, all they have to do is start slowly dumping their treasury bonds, and the dollar is going to take a terrific beating.
But don't they have an interest in keeping us afloat? For example, China, which has bought so much of our debt, China relies on the United States as its major export.
Yeah, but one of the problems is if, suppose we start heading into something of a global downturn or recession, partly linked perhaps to housing. Now, if at that point foreign countries start to sense that the United States economy is in trouble, it can't keep interest rates too high, it's got to reduce interest rates to support the economy, that'll mean the dollar slides by more or less everybody's economics. So isn't it a good idea to get out of the dollar before everybody else in Asia gets out of it, which means you come out with your assets nearly intact, and it's the Taiwanese and the Thais and the people in Hong Kong that lose a little too much. So some of the people that know a lot about this have worried about that type of scenario.
And many people are predicting that housing will tank to some degree, although not in New York, especially not Manhattan and Park Slope. But around the country, are we seeing changes already? And what will happen if the bubble, the real estate bubble, really bursts the way the dot-com bubble burst in the 80s?
Do you want a prediction from me as a way to answer this?
Sure.
What I would say is that we are probably going to see that over the course of the next 4, 5, or 6 years, the value of housing in the inflated markets stays roughly the same or retreats by 5 to 10%. Now, somebody would say, oh, that's not too bad. But if we're running up to 4 or 5% inflation a year, and that means that after 5 years it's worth a quarter less in the dollars than it was before, then your loss of 5% becomes your loss of 30%. And that gets to be pretty painful in terms of a shrinking asset.
You're one of the few people who don't seem to admire the work of Alan Greenspan.
Well, I admire his work in the sense that he's a man who can combine political shrewdness and getting along with the ability to bring off changes in monetary policy and appear to solve problems. But I think he's as aware as anybody that the future of his reputation depends on whether or not we did, in fact, and he would have been central, replace the bubble of the NASDAQ and the stock market with a bubble of debt and credit, which is what people are worried about now, led, of course, by mortgages and housing.
Bruce Bartlett says, he's a conservative, the only way out of this terrible debt is to raise taxes. Now, the Bush administration is pushing for further cuts in taxes, especially for the wealthiest part of our population. So do you think that something's going to give here?
Generally speaking, when you get in a fix like this, one of the most obvious resorts is to unacknowledged inflation. And the notion of inflating your way out of debts has been common enough in history to become a slogan. Now, inflating your way out of avoiding a housing collapse means that basically you accept that there's a real deterioration because inflation is rising, but you keep housing values roughly constant over 5 years, which means after inflation they go down 25%, but nobody really knows it. If you go back and you look at what happened to the U.S. stock market from 1973 to 1982, when we had the huge round of inflation, you would see that between the peak and the bottom, it appears to have gone down only 10%. But in fact, since prices roughly doubled, it went down two-thirds. And few people could explain exactly what happened. And I think that you're going to see an attempt to achieve something like that in the next 5 years, cushion it with mild inflation.
You seem very concerned in your analysis about the shift from a manufacturing to a financial services economy. We mentioned that earlier. You call it financialization. What exactly is financialization?
Well, financialization, in a strict definition, or at least the Kevin Phillips offered definition here, is that we've basically created financial services, which is to say the fire sector, finance, insurance, and real estate, as the dominant sector of the economy now, replacing manufacturing. And back in, say, the 1970s, manufacturing was more than 25%, and financial services were down at 10%, 11%, something like that. And now what we've got is that financial services are up to 21%, and manufacturing is down, depending on what year you use, from 12.5% to 14%. Now, finance tends to reward a smaller group of people with high skills and capital, whereas manufacturing in its day put a lot of unionized blue-collar employees in the Middle West in fishing cabins in northern Michigan. Now we're seeing the erosion of the middle class because you can't support the middle class on a financial process and wealth that largely supports the people in the top couple of percents.
And you say, I'm quoting, historically, top world economic powers have found financialization a sign of late-stage debilitation marked by excessive debt, great disparity between rich and poor, and unfolding economic decline. And you say, unless the United States proves immune from the economic laws that have heretofore prevailed, this arrangement is unsustainable.
I think that completely. It has been possible, if you go back and look at history, for small city-states that were prominent in finance, like Genoa or Venice, to basically retreat into banking and commercial services. But countries that had risen to the top as either commercial or agricultural or mining or manufacturing countries, which is to say they traded or built real things, when they moved into finance, like the Dutch in the 18th century, and we have to remember that New Amsterdam, the predecessor of New York, was the international illustration of the Dutch as the leading world power at the time of Stuyvesant. And then the British. The British thought that they could basically rule by developing this huge empire of banking and commercial services, and it turned out to not work because as they let manufacturing slip, it wasn't enough.
And in all cases, the decline was tied to diminishing energy sources.
It's related. Now, this is one that I use, but it has to be qualified. What happens and what has happened that we have to watch out for is that when a country which has had an idiosyncratic energy relationship with what became the decisive fuel has only been able to profit as long as that fuel remains decisive, and it has the principal supply. Now, the British always had coal, even when they were slipping, but the world was moving to oil, and that was the United States. The Dutch had wind and water. We think of the windmills and the ships, but it really mattered. And when coal replaced it, they couldn't get into the coal sweepstakes. We have to fear that if something is replacing oil, somebody else is going to replace the United States.
My guest is Kevin Phillips. His latest book, American Theocracy, is published by Viking. Well, have we reached the peak in oil production?
We have as Americans. The peak was reached in 1970 to 71. That's agreed upon by all the statisticians. There are some people in the United States that say that with all sorts of expensive new recovery processes, if we could conceivably pass the peak, with all sorts of expensive ways of getting more oil out, which might last another couple of years and most a couple of decades. So they pretty much agree the United States has peaked. Now the question is, how many other countries have peaked? How finite is oil, and when are we likely to run out globally? Pessimists say that the problem should be pretty considerable by the 2030s. Optimists say by the 2030s, and pessimists say we're going to see a lot more in the next 5 to 10 years.
Well, the president has called for lessening our reliance on petroleum products.
With George Bush's promise to lessen reliance on petroleum products, in 70 cents you can get a candy bar. He basically represents the oil industry. The oil industry and oil and gas is built into Washington by a history of regulatory favoritisms, tax breaks, lobbies, and the notion that anything in that dimension can be replaced by a couple of speeches on wind power or solar energy. Not as long as most of the oil coming into the country is used for transportation in general and automobiles in particular, and he shows no signs of any serious change on that. He has the oil producers, he has the motor vehicle industry, and he has the people that drive a lot, the outer suburbs.
You say that the car culture actually played a major role in the presidential election of 2004. The 13 states with 75 miles per hour speed limits, 8 in the Mountain West, North Dakota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Oklahoma, and Texas, all lopsidedly backed Bush for reelection. None of these states backed Jimmy Carter in 1980 either.
What's a lot more fun is to go into the types of cars owned by people who voted Democratic and Republican. We all think of Volvos as the sort of stereotypical liberal vehicle, but it's a hybrid. And hybrids were a 5 out of 6 for Kerry. And the big, heavy SUVs and big Oldsmobiles, the stuff my wife calls zucchinis if they're in green, and cars like that, heavily Republican. And the cutting point was sort of around convertibles, where you had money but you were young, so you were probably for Kerry.
Is it possible to reverse the trends? For example, you said that the United States is not on the cutting edge of coming up with alternatives to petroleum as the primary fuel. Couldn't we just change that the same way that we went to the moon with a serious, throwing an awful lot of money at a problem that we understood had to be solved?
No, there was no huge lobby in Washington for staying on Earth and keeping away from the moon. What we're up against this time is that we have the infrastructure of a century and a half of dominating world oil, and it's a huge infrastructure, and we have changed our military into what some are now starting to call an oil protection service. And it's easy to document that they're watching out for oil fields and pipelines and all of that. So, no, we don't change too easily.
You make it sound so bleak.
Well,
you're such a pleasant fellow.
It is bleak in a sense. And if you were to go back in 1914 and somebody who said, hey, people in England, this is happening to you now, and they would have scoffed, they would have been dead wrong. It was happening.
We want to thank our news department for the clip of President Bush in Cleveland yesterday, and Kara McCormick from the WMIC archives for the clip of Pat Robertson on the 700 Club. There is a book signing tonight at Barnes & Noble at which one? On 82nd and Broadway. And Kevin Phillips will be there. What time, Kevin?
It's 7 or 7.30. I'm not sure.
I think
which.
It's 7 o'clock. Yeah. And the book you'll be signing is American Theocracy, and it is published by Viking. It has been my great pleasure to have you on the show.
Always
again
good to talk to you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for listening to today's podcast of The Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. This was just one of the show's segments. You can hear everything we do on demand at WNYC.org. Check out our other podcasts at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.